Okay, so this finishes now the chapter 5 about evolution of software architectures, after we have talked a lot about reuse of software architecture or architectural knowledge. And now we want to move away from this, what I would call a building-oriented view. So that was the metaphor, more or less, of the lectures up to now. Where are we now? So that we more or less looked at these great tall buildings, and every second semester I have to change this slide because the buildings are getting more and more higher and higher. And what we now want to cover is not the issue of building large systems or ultra large systems or large software applications or ultra large size software applications like SAP or what else? Sugar CRM, whatever, but we want to look at the problem of building cities. Yeah, so that's more or less the other thing, that we have not only one system, one very large system from one vendor, but we have systems of systems that come from different vendors that have been developed at different times and that have to interoperate with each other. Yeah, and that's sometimes called enterprise architecture or enterprise IT architecture. Or enterprise application architecture. So the idea is one building would be one application, and the enterprise application architecture is how do you build a city with a train station, with an airport, with streets, with areas where people live, areas where people work. So what's a good city design? And as all of you know, development of cities and the city planning is a totally different profession than software architectural design of buildings. Yeah, so if you have a building, that's like what you learned also in software engineering is you have an owner of the building, and the owner more or less you are a contractor of the owner of the building, and you have to build a building in a limited amount of time with limited resources and with defined quality and with defined functional characteristics and defined performance characteristics. Yeah, that's building one high riser, for example. Yeah, and then you can be an expert in building high risers, and you build a high riser in Shanghai, and you build one in Hong Kong, and you build one in Barcelona. And that's one profession. And the other profession is if you are the mayor or the city planner of Munich, and you want to design how should Munich look like in 10 years or 15 years. Yeah. You don't build buildings at all, but you are much more concerned, let's say, how these buildings interact. Yeah, if you have too many high-risers next to each other, there's a strong wind blowing between them, or you have perhaps not enough subway accesses for all the people in the high-riser, or you have problems with the light, yeah, so because there is a shadow, it casts a shadow, or that the traffic jam, you don't have enough places where people can park their car. So therefore, if you look at an application landscape, it's not so much important, let's say, the details of the individual building, but it's more or less the interaction of the buildings by having fire stations, police stations, all of you that played SimCity, they know these problems. Yeah, if you have a big city, you get traffic jam and the people are unhappy in your SimCity environment. Yeah, so therefore, the important points are infrastructure, how to connect things, how to have flows of information between these systems. If you now move to information systems, it's not so much important, let's say, what are the interfaces of the system and what's their internal behavior and their internal performance, but it's how do they interact. Yeah, if you, for example, have a company like TU Munich and it has a TUM online system and it has an SAP system and it has a student registration system, initially there were many systems and much data had to flow between the systems. And the user experience was not so much determined by the fact whether TUM Online works nicely, but whether the TUM Online and MyTUM and the LDAP server and the password server, whether they work nicely with each other. Yeah, so therefore, the enterprise architecture management looks much more at the connections between the buildings and at infrastructure elements than at the architecture of individual systems. But again, what we will see at a later level, at the higher level of enterprise architecture and application architecture, very similar principles as we found them in software architectures also apply. Let's say coherence and loose coupling and assignment of responsibilities, elimination of redundancies, coupling over interfaces, not direct coupling, or late binding. These are all principles that appear one level higher, now not between software components, but between software components, between software systems and users of the systems and processes in the enterprise and the enterprise as a whole with neighboring enterprises. Yeah? If you look at Volkswagen, Volkswagen is not only one company, it's a large concern, a large holding, and it has many enterprises. And again, Volkswagen tries to find out which parts of Audi, Seat, whatever can be reused by the Volkswagen group, and which parts of the enterprise application landscapes of Porsche, for example, can be useful for the whole Volkswagen group. Yeah, so this is now a much larger problem, where you now abstract from the details of the building, what we did up to now, and you talk now I have buildings, they have been developed, they have interfaces, they have ownerships, they have requirements for infrastructure, how do I connect them, how do I evolve the city? And again, here it's very important that we do talk about the thing we talked evolution. Yeah, so here we don't, very small number of cities is built from scratch. Yeah, St. Petersburg, for example, Leningrad was built from scratch. Yeah, there was a king that said, okay, there's nothing and I want to have, or Karlsruhe was built by a king that had the idea when he slept that he wanted to have a circle around his, he wanted to have a castle with a circle around it, and this Karlsruhe was built by design. St. Petersburg was built by design, and some Chinese cities are right now built by design from German architects. So that's something, a very rare occasion, yeah, that you have a green field and then you put a new city there. Yeah? What happens if you play SimCity, what happens much more typical is that you have a small village and the village grows. Yeah? And then you have a larger village, you have a city. And then while the city grows, it more or less has problems with the initial structure of the city, for example, having a fortification around a German city, Stadtwall, yeah, where you have a fortification around the building, typically then becomes later on is torn down. And then you have a ring around the city where you have more or less a highway that goes around the city along, or not a highway, a street that goes around the city center. Yeah? And the city center is very packed. And then you have the outskirts with the buildings from the 19th century, yeah, and the villas of the rich people are now outside of the city center, and that's very nice to see if you see the evolution of Munich or Cologne or Hamburg or Berlin, how these cities or Paris, how they grow from an initial thing to larger districts. And while they are growing, they tear down old structures like the fortification wall, or the incoming roads, and they build along the incoming roads so that the initial structure more or less remains but is reinterpreted for the growth of the city. And again, you always have the problem that this has to be done while the system is running. Yeah, there's nothing like you move all people out of the city, you tear down the city, and then they come back. Yeah, this doesn't happen either. So therefore, you always have this idea that if you are in a city, there are always building construction going on. Yeah, you have new streets, new subway is being built, new airports, one airport is shut down, a new airport is constructed, you have a train station which is then put in a different direction like in Stuttgart, and people don't like this, yeah, because for them right now it's very bad, but for the larger development of Stuttgart for the next 100 years, it might be helpful. And all these are the problems you face if you talk about systems, architectures of systems of systems. Yeah, that these systems themselves are not flexible, but the city itself is, again, a conglomerate where you have man-made things like airports, police stations, subways, energy lines, a water supply. Yeah, all these structures are man-made. They are used by man, and this is also what happens if you have a large company with many software systems. There are existing old software systems, there are new software systems, new demands, and you have to incrementally put the new systems like iPads together with the old systems. And that's now the question, okay, what kind of architectural principles exist here at this level? And in the US, this is sometimes called ultra-large-scale systems. And the other word is enterprise architecture management, where you try to define principles and models that describe the interaction of the business architecture, the application architecture, and the IT architecture. Okay, so what I want to explain to you now is more or less coupling technologies. Yeah. So the most important things in cities are not the buildings, but the most important things are roads, subways, energy lines, telephone grid, internet supply. Yeah. So the communication between software systems is the most important thing for these systems of systems. And so therefore, I want to give you an overview, and I will not get very far today. Today and in the next lecture, about what would be called conventional middleware for distributed information systems. Now that's the classical term. So until 2005, that you talk about open distributed systems. So the idea is, or federated information systems. The idea is that you not only have clients and servers, which are from one vendor, yeah, that you have a Lotus Notes client or a Microsoft client and Microsoft server, and they are built from one vendor to interoperate, but you have so-called open distributed systems where systems from different vendors built at different times with different languages have to communicate. And these software systems are then called middleware, because they are in between the software and the operating system, and they are at a middle layer, a middle abstraction layer. And the presentation that I give to you is based on the chronological evolution, essentially, that the initial things were remote procedure call and related middleware. Then we had so-called object brokers, which had the notion of encapsulated objects with object identity and sending messages. Then we have message-oriented middleware, which is abbreviated as MOM, message-oriented middleware, like message queuing systems from IBM, or modern message-oriented middleware from the AG enterprise Java enterprise architecture. And then we have AI enterprise application integration middleware, which has higher level abstractions on top of message-oriented middleware or object brokers. This then lays the foundation for the notion of web services, which are right now, or since, let's say, 2008, rather popular, or even longer. The idea is that now that we have one infrastructure, global infrastructure, namely the World Wide Web, isn't it possible to make use of standards on top of the HTTP protocol and the web standards, URLs and URIs, to achieve now a much more open and flexible coupling than with these classical middleware components. Because the main problem of these classical middleware components is that they have been developed by software vendors initially in competition. So they were not interoperable. So Microsoft developed its own world, SAP developed its own technology, Software AG developed its own technology. And there was a strong push from users or from big companies like BMW or Mercedes-Benz or Allianz saying, okay, now we have so many different middleware components, yes, different ways of building roads. Isn't there a way that we can have more interoperability between products from different vendors? And this idea of interoperability is something that is around since the 90s. But the demands, what does it mean to have interoperability and to have security, really changed a lot since the 90s, because now you not only talk about interoperation of systems within one corporation, but you talk about interoperation between systems that are in different organizations that dynamically now want to interoperate. Yeah, and that's something that is really much more demanding and is still an ongoing topic of research, how to achieve this kind of interoperability. Because it's not only enough to have, let's say, the wires and the connections and the middleware, but you also have to make use of the middleware in a way so that the different artifacts and different interfaces can interoperate And that's something that cannot be solved by technology middleware alone. So therefore, based on web services, I will then explain next week what are service-oriented architectures and how does REST distinguish itself from web services. Are there any questions regarding these topics? So who is familiar with these words? Or which ones, who knows already RPC? Okay, who knows object brokers? Are the same? Or message-oriented middleware? Aha, okay, from which lectures now, if I may ask? From working experience, okay. Others with, from? Flüchte, okay, that's good. Okay. And web service and service-oriented architectures? Maybe even more familiar because they are newer. Okay, and REST? Okay, that's the very same. Yeah, so we have a split, and you can always comment from your practical experience whether I explain it correctly or whether this is theoretical garbage that I'm telling here. Okay, I think one book I found interesting, it's a little bit aged now in this very fast-moving area, is the book Web Service Concept Architectures Application from Gustavo Alonso and his colleagues. So that is not like the original ones, very much focused on how to write a web service, but showing more or less the development of web services based on the previous technologies. And therefore, I use this book as a starting point for my lecture. Okay, as I said, so if you now look at the interaction between systems of systems, the interesting question is how do they communicate? And essentially, there are two different ways of interaction. One is synchronous communication or asynchronous communication, which is also then called blocking communication or non-blocking communication. Synchronicity has nothing to do with concurrency and parallelism. Yeah, so the idea is, what is a synchronous or a blocking call? In a synchronous interaction, a thread of execution calling another thread must wait until the response comes back before it can proceed. Yeah, for example, here we have a thread of execution, which in Java might be actually a thread. And then in the thread, you do a request, and then your execution blocks as long until you get the response back from the invoked execution thread, which is then in a different execution environment. Yeah, this is in one software system from a different vendor, and this one is your software system. The benefit of this synchronous or blocking calls is that it behaves like an ordinary sequential program, yeah? Because either you are active or your partner is active, and while your partner is active, you don't do anything. So if your partner accesses some variable or some databases or does something, it has a sequential execution. So therefore, the state of calling thread will not change before the response comes back, so the code is much easier to read. However, this can be a significant waste of time and resources if the call takes time to complete. Yeah, so therefore, if you go, for example, down in the operating system level and you have an executing program and here you have a disk and you wait for the disk to complete, which takes a long time, typically you don't do synchronous read operations on the disk, but you do asynchronous read operations that you say, read on the disk and I do some computation and call me if you're ready. Yeah, if you do a non-blocking call. The disadvantage is that while you're doing computations, the disk call may do something, and that the notification that the disk read is ready comes back at a point in time where you really have a hard time to figure out where you sent the request. It typically happens that you have parts of your application that are written in a synchronous coupling mode. To simplify, let's say, if you do database transactions and database access, then you have this idea that you are the only user on the database and all operations are synchronized by the database management system and you do writes and you do blocking reads and blocking writes and the database management system synchronizes all the people. The bad thing about blocking systems is that you can also get deadlocks, that you wait for a reply and your client that you're calling is also calling somebody, and in the end somebody is calling you back, and you are busy waiting for the other one, you get a deadlock. Yeah? So therefore, many designs that are based on synchronous communication are very easy to understand, they are easy to be developed, but they do not scale well. Yeah? For example, if some system fails or is shut down, all systems that are synchronously coupled with this other system also are blocked or are unavailable. Yeah? So that's a typical problem we see in large systems of the financial industry. With, for example, Credit Suisse, we had a large, long project. They have a very huge mainframe where they have a lot of COBOL programs that are synchronously communicating. And what happened over time, they wrote more and more COBOL programs and they had more and more dependencies. And what happened if one of these COBOL programs has a bug or has a deadlock or has a is slow, all the other systems also become slow and slower. So therefore, what they then had to do, because the stability of the system really went down rapidly with new software releases, they wanted to find out where to move from synchronous communication to asynchronous communication to increase the reliability and availability of the system. Okay, so the other way what you can do is based on message sending. So that's the basic paradigm, message sending. Whereas the previous paradigm was function call or method call. Yeah, you call something and you wait until the result comes back. Whereas message sending, like sending an email, is you send an email and something happens or nothing happens. Yeah. So therefore, the idea is you have an execution thread and you have two kinds of operations. One is a non-blocking one, which puts a message into a queue or sends a message, yeah, to a mailbox. And then the mailbox has a store which can hold either a fixed number of messages, one message, or two messages, or 100 messages, or infinite number of messages. So that even if the receiver is not available because it's broken, or it's overloaded, or it's in maintenance, that you can continue working and all your messages are collected. The other way what you can do is you can fetch data from a queue. So therefore you say, okay, is there a new student application in the secretary? You have a pile of student applications and you take the next student application and possibly the student applications are in a priority queue so that inside the queue you can have a priority so that high priority items in the queue are put to the front. And the fetch operation only blocks if there's no incoming item. So I will be ready in 2 minutes. Hold on for a second. And then the fetch operation only blocks if the queue is empty. And then when the first item appears in the queue, the fetch operation can continue and continuous execution. By having a combination of a put and a fetch operation, you can also produce then a blocking communication. So therefore, the more primitive and more general principle of communication is message passing, and based on message passing you can build RPC, whereas the contrary is much more difficult and more unintuitive. Okay, so that was the basic understanding. Here is the definition what is middleware, and based on these basic definitions we then will categorize and describe in the next lecture the middleware components as described on the super overview page. Okay, thank you for your patience. Have a safe trip home and see you next week.